Hey, before we jump in, let's just take a minute and ask God to be our guide before we start. Father, thanks for this great privilege that we have to be able to get together each week like this, and it's really an amazing opportunity for us to be able to sing about what just an amazing God you are. And so thanks for the gift of music, and thanks for the worship team and all their preparation that helps make it so enjoyable for us and so meaningful for us to be able to spend that time preparing our hearts and our minds. And Lord, we just ask that, likewise, that you just use our time in the Word together tonight as we study. We all come in here with different things going on, and some of us are just even really tired. And I ask, God, that no matter where we are in our hearts or our heads tonight, that you would help open our hearts and our minds to be able to hear from you, and that your Spirit really would be our guide as we spend some time walking through this passage. So, God, thanks for your goodness and your grace and this amazing story of your mercy. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, Todd. All right, this is the fourth week in this series called Debating with Jesus, and we're looking at kind of these fun conversations that Jesus, has with different people, and typically they turn into debates, and tonight's kind of interesting who his debate partners end up being. And we're going to be looking at Mark chapter 5, if you want to turn there in your Bibles. And we're actually going to just spend a couple minutes reading just real quick the last couple verses of Mark chapter 4, and then we're going to go through the first 20 verses of Mark chapter 5. One of the things that's kind of fun about the Bible, if you know it well, is there are four stories about the life of Jesus: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And one of the things that's kind of cool is a lot of these really, foundational stories are told in more than one of those books. And this is a great example of that. This story is told in three of the four books about Jesus' life. And part of what makes this so interesting tonight as we look in the book of Mark is, of all of the stories about the life of Jesus, Mark is sort of like just the facts, ma'am, approach to telling about Jesus' life. It's the shortest of all of the stories about his life. It's only 16 chapters. And what's interesting is this story takes up a little more than half of one of his chapters, which is far more than any of the other accounts give us. And so clearly this is, for whatever reason, this story was really profound and really stuck out to Mark and really wanted to convey its importance to his audience, because in a short book, he spends actually a relatively, there's really only one other story in the entire book of Mark that takes up this much space. So it really, to Mark, this was a big deal that you took seriously the lessons that are available to us in this, and I think you'll see why as we go into it. The first thing is at the very end of Mark chapter 4, just to give you a little context of what's going on in here, how many of you know the story about Jesus where he's in the boat with his friends and there's a storm and he calms the storm? So that's what's going on right here at the very end. Really short. Mark condenses this down just to a couple of verses, and this is what he says in verse 38. I'll just read part of this. It says, Jesus was in the stern sleeping on a cushion. And so the storm is coming and Jesus, he's asleep in the boat. And his disciples woke him and they say, Teacher, don't you care if we drowned? And it says, he got up, and who knows if he's tired, if he's angry, frustrated, what, but he says he got up, he rebukes the wind, and he says to the waves, be quiet, be still. I'm trying to get a little nap in here, right? Then the winds died down, and it was completely calm. His disciples said to him, He said to his disciples, why are you afraid? Do you have so little faith? In other words, Jesus is saying, don't you know who I am? I promise you, there's no waves, there's no storm that's going to sink the boat while I'm with you. This isn't the way I'm going to go down, I promise you. You can have faith and trust in me that I got your back, even in a scary situation like this. And so verse 41 says, they were terrified. Why were they terrified? Not just because of the storm, but because they recognize the power Jesus has. And they ask each other, who is this guy? That's exactly what they say. Even the wind and the waves obey him. See, now this is really interesting, because you're going to see, in contrast to the other group of people that Jesus is going to spend some time having a conversation with in just a minute, his friends who have spent some time with him already and seen him do amazing things, they still really do not have any idea about the majesty and the power that Jesus possesses. And you're going to see in contrast to this other group of people in here. So in Mark chapter 5, it starts like this. It says, so from that event, it's they're going across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. Now, if you want to look and kind of orient yourself, what this looks like is if this is a map of the cities at the time of Jesus. At the bottom there is the Dead Sea. It's the lowest body of water anywhere on earth. And if you follow the Jordan River up to the top, that's the Sea of Galilee. And the Galilee, that whole region around there, is where Jesus spent most of his time teaching and doing most of his miracles. And if we kind of zoomed in on there, you can see actually that town at the very top of the lake up there is called Capernaum. And that was sort of Jesus' base of operation. Peter's home was there, and that's where Jesus spent most of his time teaching and kind of went back and forth between there. But one of the things that always amazes me, you look at this map and you go, is that like a mini Lake Tahoe? I mean, it's kind of crazy, isn't it? It really does look a lot like it. And dimension-wise, it's like 13 miles at its longest point and like 8 miles across there. So part of the reason there are these vicious storms is because if you look at the temperate zones there, on the east side of the lake is higher and temperate. It's about 25. So the Sea of Galilee, it's actually 700 feet below sea level, the lowest freshwater body anywhere on Earth. But to the east there, that goes up, the Golan Heights area goes up about 2,500 feet above sea level and drops right down into the water, which is important. You'll find out why in a couple of minutes here. And the Mediterranean Sea, which is another big body of water that's warmer, is just further out to the west. And the west side of the lake tends to be more mild in climate. So you've got all these temperature forces, different climates interacting. And that's why literally at any time of day, you could have these vicious storms that would brew up there. All year long, this is a problem. After first service, a family that had just been in Israel a couple of years ago came up to me and they said, you know what? There were two different days that we had the option to go out on a boat, and the boats that they were going out on the lake were much bigger than the boats that Jesus was on the lake in, and the weather was so bad, it was clear, but the wind was so bad on the lake that it wasn't safe for them to go out even in bigger boats. So on both the days that they were there. So that's just the reality of living and being around there. So Jesus, it tells us, is going over to the east side of the lake to this really interesting little town of Gergesa. And what's interesting about this is if you know anything about the culture and the people and what's going on in here, the first thing that you should say is you would go, what in the world is Jesus doing going over to that side of the lake? You know, sometimes we think about in life, it's kind of disappointing because even today in the world, a lot of times we're divided by like ethnic divisions and we have trouble getting along with other people of other ethnicities or other people that have other religions, different values, and we have a hard time sometimes getting along with them. And you can still see, I mean, you read in the news all the time about the strife, about that kind of stuff, unfortunately. You think that's an issue today in our world? You have no idea how bad it was during Jesus' time. I mean, the strife between ethnic groups and religions, it was absolutely cutthroat, far worse than even the problems that we see around us today. And that's the whole thing that really ought to catch your attention is, you should be saying, what is a good Jewish teacher taking this young group of influential boys over to that side of the lake? Because those guys aren't like us. See, the Jewish people on the west side of the lake, on the south part of the lake, they did, it's, you know, like off-limit signs, you know, trespassing. They did not go over there. They did not step foot in those areas, because they were Greek and Gentiles, different ethnicities, totally different religious people. In fact, they have this idea that if we go into their land, even if they're not there, we are somehow polluting ourselves. And so do you remember last week, Dan was talking about Jesus' great teaching about love your neighbor? This is one of those great things where you just go, see, Jesus doesn't just talk about what it means to move out of where it's comfortable for you to be able to be associated with other people that are different than you. Jesus didn't just tell other people to do that. He absolutely did that, and it drove his countrymen and the religious and people from his culture, it drove them mad because they go, we're the people of God and we've got it. And those people, they're bad. And whatever is going, we shouldn't have anything to do with them. Whatever God's got coming to them is good. And Jesus said, no. I'm here to help reach people that don't know, that haven't experienced the blessings, that don't know this good stuff. And I mean, I just want you to understand how absolutely extreme Jesus was in doing this. Supposing you're a really conservative Republican, you probably don't look very highly on really liberal Democrats, or vice versa. What would you think of if Jesus is always going and hanging out with those other people? Another way to think about this is, suppose you say the biggest problems in our world are financial inequities, and you think about people that work on Wall Street, brokers, and you go, those people are part of the problem that we have in this world. And Jesus is always going over to have, he's going over to their big parties in Manhattan on Fifth Avenue in their skyscrapers. What's up with that, Jesus? Those people are the problem. Why are you hanging out with them? Maybe you think that escort services are a problem in our world today. People that ply the sex trade. Jesus went and spent time and engaged in conversations with all of those people. Whoever you think is on the other side of the tracks, whoever you think, why is Jesus hanging out with that or those people? You have to understand that's exactly what's going on here. People were mystified. Why are you going to the other side of the lake? It didn't make any sense to them. A couple years ago, I was doing a service here, a funeral over at Baldwin Beach. And it was for a guy who just started his journey with Jesus. And he passed away. And his family called and asked if I would do the service. I said, sure. And I said, so what's the plan? They go, well, we're going to do it down at Baldwin. And I said, okay, and is there going to be, are we going somewhere afterwards? Yeah, we're going over to Whiskey Dick's to hang out. And I go, okay. And it made perfect sense to me because most of his friends, that's where he spent a large part of his adult life, was hanging out over there. So, all right, cool. So I go to the funeral and I'm the religious guy amongst all these other very non-religious people. And, it's the sort of thing where they go, they cuss and they go, oh, sorry, pastor. Right? And I tell them, oh, don't worry about it. My wife cusses all the time, right? And it's like they have this idea that I'm, and it made me sad to think that they saw me as someone so different than them. Because the thing I told them is I said, I want you to know that this Jesus thing isn't for the people that have it all together. I said, if Jesus came to town this week, I promise you, Jesus is not coming to Noah's office to go, hey, let's have a Bible study this week, Noah. Love to study the Bible. Jesus is going to be with you guys at Whiskey Dick's. Jesus wants, he's good with me. He's happy I'm doing whatever I'm doing. But Jesus wants to reach people that think he doesn't want to have anything to do with. Those are the very people that Jesus goes to, right? And so, I just throw that out as a reminder for you when you think about when Jesus says, love your enemies. He says, pray for those who persecute you. This is that whole radical, gracious, good love that God has for the world. And man, he wants everybody to know it, and he'll go to great lengths to help people see that and get it. So it goes on, he goes over to the side of the lake, and when he got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. So you get this picture of this guy's, there's something going on with him. He's a little crazy, right? It goes on to say, for he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. There was no one that was strong enough to subdue him. I mean, this was serious Arnold Schwarzenegger guy, right? I mean, crazy. And night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he'd cry out and cut himself with stones. A picture of a very sad person who's tormented clearly. And people are they're scared of this guy, and they don't have a way to even protect themselves from him. And so he's living out literally in the caves on the east side of the Galilee here below this town, where they would put dead bodies in these tombs. And that's where this guy, that's where his dwelling was. You're going to find out why this is true here as the story goes on. It says, so when this guy, when he sees Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. And he shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me?" Now you're going to come to find out that this guy is possessed by a whole bunch of demons. And one of the things that's really unfortunate about the English language is it does not do a very good job of actually conveying like the Greek of what it says here. Because the Greek actually says this. It says, what do you and I have in common? That's exactly what the demons are saying to this guy, Jesus. They're saying, what you're about, what you represent, what you want to do in the world, it's in complete opposition to everything that we are about. And what we want to do, and our purposes, and what we want to accomplish in the world. There's nothing, we have no agreement together, right? And what's interesting is people go, well, if this was a demon-possessed man, why would he run? If Jesus is over there, why does he go this way? And I want to tell you why. Dan and I were talking about this between services. Because there is no hiding from God. There is no hiding to get away from him. And in fact, the demons know that their only hope in this situation is to actually go and beg Jesus. And that's exactly what these guys are going to do. So you think about this opposition between Jesus and satanic influences or power in the world. Jesus spells this out really clearly in John chapter 10, where he says, the thief, he comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. And then Jesus says, and I've come that they may have life, right? What a beautiful picture of what Jesus is all about. And he's saying, this is what Satan and his emissaries are all about and what their goals are. Couldn't be clearer what the difference is. And that word in there, destroy, which is also used in this story, it's the word apolemi in Greek. And this guy who's possessed by a demon, that tragic picture is exactly what that word destroy means. It means to render something of value and make it useless. And that really is a tragedy when you think about, I mean, obviously you take something that like a tool, like a spoon to stir soup, and if you use it as a hammer, you render it useless. It will no longer serve its good purpose. But that's a bummer, right? But it's a tragedy when it's a person that was made in God's image and his likeness to serve his good purposes in the world, and Satan's entire intent is to render humans useless and destroy the very purpose that God intended, the good intention that he intended for them. And so what do they say to Jesus? It's funny, listen to how they address Jesus. It says, Jesus, the Son of the Most High God? See, there's almost like there's this recognition, like they actually know exactly who this guy is. That term, Son of the Most High God, they understand that Jesus, it's a phrase of divinity. They recognize who Jesus is. There's no doubt in their mind, right? And what do they say? They recognize not only who he is, but what his power is, because they're scared to death that Jesus is going to torture them for the bad things that they've been doing. So they say, in God's name, don't torture me. For Jesus had said to the guy, come out, you impure spirits. Then Jesus asked him, he said to them, he says, what's your name? And the demon replies, Legion, for we are many. And that's a Roman term for their garrisons, anywhere from 2,500 up to 6,000 soldiers. So the whole picture here is there's a whole lot of inhabitants, demonic influences in this guy's life. Verse 10 says, and he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. And if you read this remember I told you this is both in Matthew and Luke. And if you read this in Luke, it's really interesting, because the one thing that's one of the small differences is they beg Jesus not to send them into the abyss. And so the abyss, the only other place that word abyss is used is in Revelation. Go look it up in chapters 5, 9, 11, and twice in 20. And it's all used to talk about the same place, which is there will be a time where God finally rounds up all the evil forces in the world, and that is that pit is where they will all go. It's jail for demons is a way to think about this. And these guys know it's not a good place to go. And that's their concern right here, is that Jesus is coming to send them there now. And they have the sense of like, wait a minute, Jesus, this isn't the time. You haven't stamped your final victory on us. So why are you sending us out of here now? That's their argument that they're having with him. They're like, this can't be the right time. And so are they scared? Think about this. These guys, they know who Jesus is. They know what his power is. And they know what their destiny is. Remember I told you at the beginning of the story, like his buddies that are spending time with him? They really don't get who Jesus is. Do the demons know who Jesus is? It's pretty clear, without a doubt. They get it. They know exactly who he is. So they begged him not to send him out of the area. There's a large herd of pigs that was feeding on a hillside nearby. And that same couple says that if you go to Israel today, you can go to the east side of the lake. And on the east side of the lake, you can still see these pens that they have. And people are still breeding pigs on that side of the lake, even to this day. And they're on these slopes that are really steep. And a large herd of pigs was feeding nearby. And the demons begged Jesus, send us among the pigs and allow us to go into them. That's their desire. And I just, people always want to talk about demon possession, and that's really, I don't have time to spend much time on that. So I'll just say this real quick. We live in a world where people suffer from mental illness, bouts of mental illness and depression all the time. And I just, this is what's important to me to say about this today, is we should take it really seriously. It's not a joke. It's not something we should ignore, because it can have really significant, severe consequences. And there, besides just demon possession, I mean, there's a number of reasons why people suffer with these things, right? They can be psychological, physiological, chemical. They can be environmental issues. I mean, there's so many different things, and it can be a contributing factor of all of those things. And what's important is that if you have any sense that you're struggling with any of those issues, or especially if somebody, a close friend of yours, says, hey, I'm worried about you right now, take it seriously. Let's get together and spend some time figuring out, is this spiritual? Or what is really going on? Let's spend some time talking about how we can find and help you get through whatever that challenge is that you're working through. I do want to say this about demonic activity in the world today. I think that that Satan and his demons, they are real. We spend a lot of time talking about God and his good power and influence in the world today, and that's absolutely true. But we don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about how important it is to be aware that there really is, the demonic world is real and has an influence in the world and still wants to do the same thing in opposition to all of God's good plans. And I think that if you read in the rest of the New Testament, the overt, like what this guy is going through, that overt demonic presence seems, there's not a lot of it as you read through the rest of the New Testament. And I'm not sure that, especially in the Western world today, that we see a ton of this, but certainly it is. It certainly does happen from time to time in our world today, absolutely. But I do think that this is the real big thing that every single person in here needs to be aware of. Is Satan is crafty, and he will do whatever he can to distract you from God's good purposes. And that's exactly what Paul says in 2 Corinthians. When he talks about, he says, there are these false teachers that are coming in your midst, and they're sounding really good, like, hey, we're from God, but they really have a totally different agenda. And Paul says, it's no wonder that people would be fakers, because he says that's what Satan is. Satan masquerades as what? An angel of light. See, Satan's best tactic for most of us in this world today is just that subtle attraction to draw you away from God's good purposes. And that can happen in so many different ways. That's Satan's goal, is just, He knows if he can get you off focused on God just a little bit, the further you go, guess what? The further off course you're going to be navigating in life. A really good way of thinking about Satan's subtle practice in the world today is this classic book by C.S. Lewis called Screwtape Letters. And it's a really, it's this great picture to think about how I think Satan is alive and at work and his demons work in the world today. And it's this fictitious account of this group of letters between these two demons. And the senior demon who has been tempting people for a long time is represented by this guy named Screwtape in the book. And he's got somebody who is like a younger demon, and he's helping coach him along in how to do his work. And it's this fantastic exchange of letters back and forth. And over again, that's the whole purpose. He says, look, the whole goal is to be crafty and subtle. Don't let the guy even know that you're twisting his emotions, his thoughts, his wants, and his desires. See, that's where Satan, I mean, you get that, don't you? Adam and Eve in the garden, does Satan come and go, rah! We read the serpent thing, and that's what we think is going on. But notice, what does the serpent do? The serpent is a picture of craftiness. He just takes God's words and just manipulates God's very own words just this much. Just subtly. And I'm convinced that Satan still does that same thing very well in our world today. So he gave these demons permission, and the impure spirits come out and they go into the pigs of this herd, and about 2,000 of them in numbers, the pigs, they rush down the steep banks into the lake where they were drowned. So the theological Greek term for this is swine dive. A little pig humor for you there, sorry. All right, those tending the pigs ran off and reported this to the town and the countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons, and he's sitting there. Mark tells us that the guy's naked out in these tombs, and he's been in that condition for a long time. The guy is now dressed, and he's in his right mind, and the people in the town, they're terrified. Why are they not excited? Because they get that their best efforts, they haven't been able to do anything to help this guy at all. And somebody comes along and like that, everything changes. That's why they're terrified. They don't get this. They don't understand that kind of power. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Verse 17 says, the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. How bizarre is that? I'll tell you why I think this happens in just a minute. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with Jesus, right? Now, think about this for a second. If Jesus, part of Jesus' thing is does he not want people to know that he's got all this power, he's this amazing guy? Actually, Jesus he's not an overt guy at all like that. But I mean, think about this from our human perspective of, what a cool dog and pony show Jesus has got right there in his hand. I mean, think Jesus goes, hey, come with me, buddy. Because Jesus could parade this guy out everywhere and all over that region to say, you all know who this guy was. And this is the power of God alive and at work. I mean, what a great demonstration of exactly who Jesus is and what he's capable of, right? And here's the real kicker to this whole thing. Jesus, everywhere he goes, he's always asking people to what? His big call is, he says, come. Yeah, one person knows this. What does he say? Yeah, come. I mean, isn't that what Jesus says everywhere he goes? Come follow me. Here's a guy who's out ahead of the game, and he says, hey, Jesus, I want to come with you. Right? What a cool thing. And here's the last twist in this story, because Jesus says, no. Jesus says, go back to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you, how he's had mercy on you. So he went away and began to tell in the Decapolis, so that's a 10-city region on that east side of the lake, how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed at this guy's testimony. And that's why, that's in your notes, if you look at the top there, that's where I get this idea of this guy. He was a maniac. And he is actually the very first missionary that Jesus sends out. And I'll tell you why that's so profound in just one second. Two things I want you to think about before we celebrate communion here together. First one is this. Our culture loves reality TV shows. And one of the greatest genres of reality TV show is like the makeover, the home makeover thing. Sometimes it's people buying a house and they go, hey, if we buy this house and we make these changes to it, we'll be able to resale it and make some money. And it's like, people are like, oh, this is so cool, so fun to watch. Look at the transformation that's going on there, right? Another way we see this genre working out a lot of times is like people that are not healthy, maybe they're overweight, and they go to a personal trainer and they say, help rearrange my diet and my exercise regimen so I can get healthy. And we love it. We like the before and after pictures. The gym that I belong to, they're doing that sort of thing right now. And you know what's interesting about this? I was talking to someone in town the other day. They're not even a part of this gym, but they found out about this, and they're like, I want to do that. So they don't even belong to the gym, but they like this idea, this challenge. It's a short-term challenge to transform. We like these sort of, this idea of change, and maybe we'll go to the salon, right? Get a new haircut. Whatever, we like change. But here's the reality. Let's be honest. We like looking at things that are go from one state to another, and we like the improvement that we see. We're all for that. But none of us, be totally honest, none of us just wants to hand somebody else the keys and say, make of my life what you want. That's not a bargain that any of us are quick to sign up for at all. And I want to tell you, that's exactly why these townspeople go, get out of here, get in the boat and go away. Because everything that Jesus has done in their town, he has flipped all this stuff upside down and he's unpredictable. And they know if this guy stays with us, we don't know what's going to happen to our world. It's unpredictable, and it's clear that he's got power to do. And he's not negotiating with us about how to do this stuff. He's just doing it. And that terrifies them. They've got their own cozy, comfortable little lives, and they don't want to turn their life over to him. But I want you to think about this. See, that is the rational thing to do if Jesus is who he says he is. If Jesus is really God, why would you not take your life and go, have your way with me? I want you just for a minute to take an honest glimpse into your own heart to understand how selfish we are. Because none of us really wants to do that. Because at some level, we all think we know better than Jesus does how to run our life. You want to talk about pride and arrogance. It's that we would tell the God of the universe that we know better than him how to run our lives. If that's not arrogance and pride, I don't know what is. But you see, that's really the proposition that a sane person would say, Jesus is, and he does know better. Why would I not say, I rend my life over to you? See, that's what that you think about insanity. Insanity is saying, I know better than you do. That's insanity. Sanity would be saying, that's what makes sense. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's not scary, but I just am saying, look, let's just be honest about who Jesus is and who we are and what, in terms of orienting ourselves in an honest way before him, what that would really look like in our lives. And I'll tell you, it's a scary thing. When I first got married, we lived in this little apartment in Phoenix, and I'd come home when we first got married, and I'd walk in the door, and sometimes I'd go like, wait a minute, is this really my apartment? I just have to go back out and look at the door number to make sure this was like my apartment, because everything was rearranged, right? And it took me a while to figure out that my wife just liked changing things around. And it took me a while to figure out that that was good and cool and it's not a big deal. And so one week I even decided while she was gone, I thought, I'll rearrange the... Yeah, you all know how well that worked. See, my wife liked doing the rearranging, but she wasn't excited about... And that's the reality of how most... That's really how most of us are in life. John Ortberg, in talking about this whole scary scenario, talks about when his teenage daughter got her driver's permit. And he goes from the driver's seat to the passenger seat. And this is exactly what he says. It's a big moment in your life when you hand someone else the keys, when you trade seats in the car, because up till now, I've been driving. I choose the destination. I choose the route. I choose the speed. But if we're going to change seats, if you're going to drive, that's the whole ball game. It really is. And that's, I mean, this is a small thing, but it really is a good picture of what this looks like. Of saying, you know what, I'll give. See, unfortunately, God isn't a teenage son or daughter driving a car, right? Which is good news. But that's really, I think that's a great picture of what this looks like and why it's a challenge, but it really is the same challenge. Now, I you can't walk away from this passage without thinking about this. So, like, we get a couple people interacting with Jesus throughout these stories, right? Jesus, obviously, he knows it all. He's got all the power, right? He's got all the authority, and he can exert it any way he wants, and that's so clear in this story. Let me just ask you this really funny question. Who else in this story is really smart? Who else in this story really understands who God is? Who else in this story really understands God's authority and power? Who else in the story really understands what their final destiny is? Who is it? Isn't that weird to think about? See, when nobody else can figure out who the heck this Jesus guy is, these demons know exactly who he is. You know, when they come to Jesus, they know it's not going to do us any good to hide in the caves because Jesus is going to come find us. He's here for us. So that's why they go and they throw themselves at his feet. You know what that word is? It's crazy. That Greek word where they come and they present themselves to Jesus, it's the same word as prostrating yourself in worship. They know exactly who he is. They know exactly his power. That's why they're begging. See, they are orthodox. They're right in their thinking about God. And wouldn't this be cool? See, I wish... that if my ticket to heaven was like a theological test, like knowing the right information, I'd love that. You go, if you've been to my office, you see all the books and you know how much reading I do. I love theology. I love looking at difficult questions. I love that stuff. It's my passion. And I would love it if like the entrance into heaven was like you get up there and Peter's there with a clipboard and he says, Noah, the virgin birth. Disagree, agree, strongly agree. See, I would get these test questions right. How much help is it for these demons that know probably way more than you or I will ever know this side of eternity? See, don't ever fall into the trap of thinking that your problem of living in your oriented God in a healthy way is an information problem. Because there's someone in the story who I promise you does not know this stuff. This guy doesn't, you get this, don't you? This guy would not pass a theology test. He's a Greek guy. He knows nothing about this stuff. Does he know that Jesus is going to die on the cross for his sins? Does he get that stuff? No. All of the big stuff, this guy knows nothing about. And yet, here's the crazy thing. His heart has been transformed so that when Jesus tells him to do something that's the opposite of what he wants to do, he says, all right, I'll do it. I'll go. See, he understands something really crucial, which is Jesus has done for, he has saved my life. He's done for me what I couldn't do for myself. And he totally gets that. And that changes everything for him. He goes, I can trust you with anything. And that's exactly why this guy is willing to put his life in Jesus' hand. What's crazy about this is if you go on to read in Mark chapter 7, you go, that guy, like going and talking to other people, did it really make a difference? When Jesus actually comes back to this region a couple chapters later, he gets a different reception, and they're excited to have him there. Last quote for you in here. So like this whole idea of like, is information like the key to transformation? Rick McKinley in his book, Faith for This Moment, he says, in America, we assume that our primary issue when it comes to faith or any other topic, it's that we need more information to understand how to do the things we want to do. It's true, from weight loss to worship. We assume that we lack information and believe that if we only had the right information, then we would, and that's the key word, then we would naturally do the things we want to do. And he says, what we really lack is not information, but appropriate desires that move us towards the right things. And the only person that can really do that kind of transformation in our hearts is Jesus. And you can see that that's exactly what's happened in this guy's life, because Jesus has saved him right here and now. Nobody else has been able to save this guy. He hasn't been able to help himself. And Jesus comes and absolutely delivers him miraculously. And that changes everything for him. And I would render to you to consider that that's exactly what would happen in your life when you really consider the forgiveness and the grace and the mercy that God has shown every one of us. See, that's sort of the issue is, a lot of times we read a passage like this, and we go, oh, it's good. That guy really needs Jesus. But me? Seeing that, if you do that, you'll discount the whole beauty of what Jesus did for you. You think about, like, anybody consider how odd it is, the switching of places that happens? At the end of the book of Mark, who's naked? Who is stripped of their clothes? Who was physically beaten and bleeding? Who was driven off into the tombs? And who was crying out? It's no longer a guy, but it's Jesus. See, Jesus's cure for the problems of sin and death in the world isn't to push it into the pigs, but ultimately his victory that he claims is that he takes all that onto himself. And that's why Jesus has the ability to be the final arbiter and authority and judge and stamps his victory on the world and over evil and can declare us clean also. Because he's the only person that could do that. You certainly can't help yourself in that regard, and nobody else can save you. But there is one person that can deliver you in the same way that this guy needed deliverance, and that's Jesus. And that's why we celebrate communion tonight, because it's just a really good opportunity, a practical reminder of exactly what Jesus did for us and exactly what we really trust for our life. And so what we're going to do here is the folks in the back row, you're going to come up on the outside, come around the table. I'm going to have you take a cracker and a cup and head back to your seat. And just one quick reminder for you, too. You don't have to be a member of Sierra Community Church to participate in communion. All that matters is that when we talk about who do you trust for forgiveness and salvation, is it Jesus? And if that's true of you, then I'd love for you to participate in communion. It doesn't mean that you're perfect. It doesn't mean that you haven't messed up this week. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that you're not going to mess up today or tomorrow. But it just means that you understand that Jesus did for you what you can't do for yourself. If you're not sure about that, you still have questions, I'd love to talk to you after the service about what that looks like. That's what we're here for. And if for the very first time tonight you go, that's actually, I've lived my life trusting in other things, believing that something else could help me or solve the problems of my life. And if you go, you know what, that makes sense that Jesus really can. He's the only one that can do for me. He's the only one who can absolve me of my sins and can bring forgiveness and cleansing and healing. If you know that's true, you don't have to beg God. You don't have to come up with these fancy words. All you have to say is, thank you, God, for what you did for me, and I trust in you. And if that tonight could be the very first time you say that, and if that's true, love for you to participate in communion. But folks in the back, if you'll come up, come grab your elements, head back up the center aisle, and we'll partake of the bread and the cup together tonight.